Live at 204 Berry Street in downtown Kingston. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at Old Farm FF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
Danger, danger. The following contains explicit content. Please use caution while you are tuned in.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls, and you're listening to Rainbow Country.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the persons appearing on the program.
Today on Rainbow Country, gender-affirming healthcare with award-winning medical professional, Dr. Kriya Gishin, who joins me to talk about facial feminization surgery. That and more in episode 434, so stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hello, my name is Conchita.
And I'm Barbecue.
And my name is Hardcora. And we are the B-Girls.
You're listening to
Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada from coast to coast to coast. The Yukon, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, the east coast of Canada in Newfoundland, Ontario, even down to Buffalo, New York, and online. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being recognized as a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So, today, she's co-authored a number of peer-reviewed medical journal articles. She also has a successful Beverly Hills practice. Award-winning medical professional Dr. Kriya Gishin is my guest and joins me on this episode to talk about gender-affirming healthcare. We'll find out all about facial feminization surgery and more. Plus in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. And on this episode, I'm featuring some classic house, some queer electronic, and more. All that lies ahead as we start journey 434 through Rainbow Country. And our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning writer Paige Mailot reads from her memoir, My Body is Distant, a book that tells the author's trans journey to self-realization. By the way, on Amazon.ca, My Body is Distant has a rating of 5 out of 5 stars.
Memory is a slippery and selective thing. To provide an example, think back to your earliest memory. One of mine was a hot summer day in 1979. I would have been 4 years old and my sister Lana only 2. The memory begins with us running barefoot across cool, shaded grass behind the turn-of-the-century schoolhouse our father skillfully converted into our childhood home. As I ran and Lana chased after me, grasshoppers sprang from the grass, cicadas screeched in the trees, and the neighbor's cows grazed in fields on the other side of the electrified fences which surrounded our property. Already, I have fabricated details to draw you into my story. While I know there were often cows in the fields which surrounded our house, and that cicadas often screeched in the trees, I don't remember how warm it really was. And I can't recall whether cicadas were out or if there were cows nearby that day. I have only included these pseudo-facts to pave the way to a moment that stuck with and still shapes who I am some 40-something years later. I remember we found ourselves in the sun-warmed, wood-scented back shed where we discovered my father's tackle box. We pried open squeaky metal clasps, and inside we found the most incredible fishing lures. To our inexperienced eyes, they looked uncannily like actual fish, with shining scales drawn with metallic paints and gleaming bright eyes. Some were hinged in the middle to mimic realistic swimming, I assume. Lana grabbed as many fish as she could, somehow avoiding hooking herself. She looked up at me, her body vibrating with excitement as she said, "Let's see them swim." I agreed and gathered the rest. We ran out of the shed and across the lawn holding handfuls of jingling fish. I followed Lana to a deep circular pond ringed with flagstones, which my father had dug in the middle of our yard. Lana wasted no time as she climbed the stones and threw her handfuls into the water. When they struck the surface, years of dust splashed away and the lures came to life. The tiny fishes twisted and flipped just below the surface. Their chromatic scales flashed in a dizzying rainbow of colors before they sank. Each twinkled in the sunlight one last time, as if giving thanks, before they disappeared into the murky depths of the pond. "Did you see that?" Lana asked. "Throw yours." I recognized the potential consequences of tossing away my father's prized fishing lures, but I couldn't help myself. I wanted to see those colors. I needed to see if they truly could come to life again. I tossed mine, alone and in twos, at Lana's impatient urgings. We watched with amazement as they rolled and flashed in the murky water as they sank, leaving us with vivid memories and regret. For me, memory is a lot like my fish story. I only seem to remember moments which particularly delight or trouble me, and sometimes the ones that flash brightest are the ones that do both. I like to think my brightest memories are also the ones which have taught me valuable lessons, like how throwing away antique heirloom fishing lures can make your father cry. This memoir is, therefore, imperfect. It will contain details as true as I can remember them, and I'm certain some recollections will be incorrect or incomplete. All I can promise is that the memories in these pages are, to the best of my knowledge, influential moments of my life which have shaped me into the woman I am today. I hope you graciously accept that possibility as I recall these stories with you. By reading them, you can cause these memories to flash and sparkle once more. While not every recollection in this memoir shines, I believe it is important to include the difficult parts and the ones that beacon on regrettable decisions. Because if we don't record these multicolored memories as accurately as possible, they might sink into the darkness and be lost forever. 2010, another 11 years later, in an abandoned amusement park. Emerging from a cloud of rose-scented mist, Callie's face is lit electric pink as we pass a buzzing neon heart on the tunnel's rocky wall. We float together in a giant rubber duck that pulls us along a submerged track toward an expanding arch of light. As we pass through the cave's mouth, sunlight gleams off the duck's droplet-sprinkled plastic wings, and the sequined lining of my bridal gown reflects shimmering rainbows across the water's surface. Callie caresses my ears. What did you think? Best honeymoon ever, I say. We're only getting started. A sly smirk hints at the corner of Callie's mouth as he pulls me close. I rest my cheek against his suit-covered chest, allowing myself to melt into the relaxing vibration of his affectionate purring. Being here, having him holding me, sharing this moment together in an actual tunnel of love with my husband has made all the fuss of the past 2 weeks of wedding mayhem worthwhile. This does truly feel perfect, even though I know that none of this is real. Not in the way most people value realness. I know this amusement park we're in, this plastic duck boat, and even our avatars are just lines of code stored on a softly humming server somewhere. Despite that, I feel an authentic bond with Callie, which is no less valid than the intimacy and trust that accompanies sharing your bed and life with someone in the real world. In loving relationships, we seek reassurances that our partner cares for us. Grand romantic gestures may be beautiful and sweep you off your feet, but they're easily staged. We communicate true love through a multitude of selfless moments. Love appears as an unprompted cup of tea, just the way you like it on a tough day. Or when you fawn over a beautiful sweater and a week later, it appears on the dining room table, even when it's not your birthday. Genuine gestures of love can even appear in an act as simple as being cuddled as the little spoon while you drift off to sleep. Despite what you might think, these gestures can mean more online. Callie's wedding suit is an excellent example. If he and I married in real life, he might buy or rent a suit. A tailor then measures and makes alterations, but all Callie has done is point and pay and pick it up when he's ready. Here, Callie inevitably tried on multiple suits from multiple online vendors, still spent real money to buy it, but then he also sank hours in an editor, carefully tweaking the suit's proportions to accommodate his unique furry body. It took me 3 days to find and fit a bridal dress that showed my tail and then edit a veil so that it didn't cut off my ears. Callie proposed with an emerald ring. While he likely didn't spend too much to buy it, he took the time to learn I preferred emeralds to diamonds. Communication and attention to detail mattered just as much here. He also scouted this abandoned amusement park for us to be alone. Thoughtful kindnesses like these are more than I've ever experienced in a real-life relationship. In some ways, online relationships better illustrate commitment and desire. In real life, you and I might walk together. Your hand might bump mine, and we might like the feeling of accidental touch enough to hold hands. It could be sweet, but there's a casualness to this act that cannot occur online. In virtual worlds, we might similarly walk together, but you would intentionally position your character closer to mine, target me, and initiate a command like, slash hold hands with Lydia. While stepping out of a romantic moment to type may sound detached, if my online partner values the time required to specifically write an affectionate gesture just because they want to build a connection, doesn't that add something? Describing a character's intention is not only precise and deliberate, but every descriptive pose my partner writes is only for me, for us, to create our memorable moment. Whether we're holding hands or fighting or fucking, we craft line after line of descriptive prose, a conscious, poetic rededication to the value of our relationship. So, yes. I know that our relationship, our marriage, and this moment are not real in the way society might define it, but for a lonely and sick trans woman, they are everything. Besides, don't scientists say reality as we understand it might be lines of code anyway?
We think of the 1970s as the period where the gay community was trying to get noticed. The 1980s was the time when we actually got noticed and started getting seriously slammed. The cops had never been happy with Trudeau's 1969 decriminalization. If you look at historian Tom Hooper's work, you'll see that arrests of gay men actually increased across the country after decriminalization. Remember, this was way before apps. If you wanted to hook up, baths or bars were the best places to go, so those were the places that police targeted. There were a series of bath and bar raids in Montreal and Toronto and Edmonton and Ottawa and other cities. The Toronto bath raids of February 5th, 1981 are the most famous. When Toronto's pro-gay mayor John Sewell and the first openly gay candidate for city council, George Hislop, were both defeated in the municipal elections in 1980, the cops figured we were vulnerable and swooped. They smashed into most of the city's gay baths, trashed the places, and arrested almost 300 men on a range of charges. It wasn't just the baths, they were also hassling the bars on concocted liquor license violations, and they were busting individuals in bookstores for porn. Basically, they were trying to shut down the gay village and recriminalize homosexuality. But that night when they hit the baths, they bit off more than they could chew. In Toronto, for the first time, the activists and the small business people and the normally non-political bar and bath patrons all came together in a series of massive demonstrations. We raised money to fight the charges in court and won. We made common cause with Black and South Asian communities who are also experiencing police brutality and harassment, and we demanded community control of the police. We called for changes to the criminal code to get rid of antiquated laws that still criminalized sex. That new community unity also laid the foundation for dealing with the next crisis that was about to affect us all, the AIDS epidemic. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, we find out all about facial feminization surgery.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Kara Gishin, hi, how are you?
Good, how are you? Thank you for having me.
I am well, thank you for being here. Okay, I'm sure I butchered your name. How do you say it?
So my first name is Kriya.
Kriya.
Yes.
Okay, okay. I have to say thank you for being here. So,
thank you. I really appreciate it.
You are more than welcome. You are a leading surgeon in facial feminization surgery. Facial feminization surgery. I'm sure most people can picture what that might be, but what does it entail? What is it that you're essentially doing and fixing?
Right.
So to speak, in a nutshell.
Yeah. So, you know, the procedure is very individualized per patient, and it means something different to every patient that I operate on. So just sort of in general, if we were to say, what are the steps of the surgery entail? And obviously, I won't go into too much medical detail or gore detail, but, you know, we're looking at the facial features. And for my patients who are seeking gender affirming surgery, we're trying to make those features fit what they feel on the inside, sort of, and to make their face match who they are so that their outside and how they're presenting themselves to the world sort of represents what they're feeling and who they are on the inside. And in order to do that, you know, we have to manipulate the skeletal bones and the soft tissues of the face, because when we look at you know, the female skull and the male skull, they are very different in their structure. And so what we're doing is we're trying to make those changes so that the skeletal appearance and the soft tissue appearance is softer, a little rounder, a little more feminine, a little less chiseled, so that the facial appearance is something that the patient is proud to present to the outside world. Mm.
So you have your very own successful Beverly Hills practice. Well done to you. Who would you say is your typical client? Or is there such a thing as a typical client when it comes to something like this?
You know, it's such a personal experience. And I feel like particularly with any kind of gender affirming surgery, it is a surgery that really requires tailoring to the patient's needs. And, you know, so for facial feminization, I have a lot of transgender women coming into my office who say, you know, I've gone through this, I'm going through this process. Some people start with their face. Actually, a lot of people start with their face because that's the thing the whole outside world sees, right? And they say, I just want to pass. I just want to be accepted as a woman in society. And I feel like my really strong facial features are preventing me from being able to fully integrate as a woman in society. And so I'll have patients who are anywhere on their journey. A lot of them are in the beginning of their journey. A lot of patients will do sort of the top surgeries and bottom surgeries before, and then their face is the last thing that they come in and want changed. So I definitely get patients sort of at all ends of their process, but it's for the most part, a lot of my patients seeking facial feminization are patients who are transgender women. You know, I also more recently have been getting a lot of non-binary patients who say, you know, we want just smaller changes and we want to really fit a non-binary sort of gender or lack thereof. And so those changes, that's something that I'm starting to see more of. I saw less of that initially, and that's something that is becoming more and more popular. And those patients, really, we have to form a really tight knit relationship because I have to very much understand what they're looking for.
So with your practice then, what percentage are transgender clients of yours?
So because it's my specialty and my focus and my passion, it's a very large percentage of my practice. I would say that it's probably at least 60 to 70% of my practice.
Wow. In Beverly Hills.
Yeah. So you know, when I started this, there are transgender centers at big hospitals and academic institutions, but when I did a facial feminization fellowship or craniofacial fellowship at UCLA with one of the leaders in the field, Justine Lee, and she really sort of did all the virtual planning and has honed the surgery. And so she gave me that skill set to be able to do this. And her and Wayne Ozaki over at UCLA really do a ton of these surgeries. And so I fell in love with it. I knew I wanted to do this. But what I recognized was that in the private practice space, there are not a ton of specialists who have that extra training specifically focused on facial feminization and facial work for gender-affirming care. And, you know, many plastic surgeons will do some of it, but not the whole surgery. And a lot of plastic surgeons will do the soft tissue stuff, but they won't do all the bone and the skull restructuring because you need that extra training really to be able to do it effectively. And so I realized there just weren't that many surgeons in sort of the private space. So yeah, you can go to a hospital and you have to go through the hospital system to get the surgery. But if you really want that one-on-one relationship with your surgeon in a smaller system and sort of like a family setting of their office, there really just wasn't that much available. And so I knew I wanted to bring that to patients because it's a very different experience than going into a hospital experience and having the surgery.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to you. I'm in Canada, in Toronto, and I know that part of the healthcare system now, they're offering gender-affirming surgeries to varying degrees, but it's covered, to the best of my knowledge. You're in California, and for people seeking this out in America, is this something that is you know, they have to pay out of pocket for?
Not necessarily. So it really depends on every patient's insurance policy and how much of it is covered by their insurance policy. I will work with all of the insurance providers, and basically I negotiate with the insurances to cover the costs for the patients. But whether or not the patients have, for example, copays or deductibles or all of that, that is very dependent on their insurance policy. And that's much the same as the rest of their health care. So if their health care and their policy covers gender-affirming care, then I'm willing to work with the insurance to make sure it gets covered for the patient. And I think that that's, you know, the best way to do it. Fortunately, in California, we're in a state where gender rights are taken seriously and where our political system is protecting gender rights. So, you know, the insurance companies, if they are promising benefits to patients, they have to honor that. And so, you know, in California, it's a little easier. In other states in America, it has become either, you know, illegal or very, very difficult to get these cases covered by insurance, if not impossible. Which is very unfortunate. But in California, we are still a state, thank goodness, that works with patients.
So you deal with feminization. Are there, when it comes to, you know, female to male in regards to trans individuals, are there people that deal with, you know, like to make someone look more masculine?
I do that too. It's just okay. Much less. So when I did my fellowship, it's craniofacial. So it was, you know, anything related to the facial skeleton, and soft tissue. And you do get facial masculinization cases. It's a much smaller case in general. When you're starting with an anatomically female skull, the biggest sort of difference is the jawbone area. And so when I have patients who have an anatomically female skull, but they identify as male, a lot of those patients really just want to focus on their jawline. And in order to do that, you know, we use a lot of implants. We can either use bone or we can use like prefabricated implants that we're able to put into the jawline area. And that really masculinizes the skeletal structure. Another area that, you know, patients have started to look at, which is not commonly done, but is the brow, because that's another sort of big difference in the anatomic male and female skull. So when I'm doing a facial feminization, I want to decrease the prominence of the brow. If you're doing a masculinization, you know, most patients don't actually seek enhancement of the brow, but it is something that we can work with a little bit. But it's in general a less common surgery, and it is a much shorter surgery to do a facial masculinization. It's a much less detailed surgery.
And do you also do tracheal shaving?
So tracheal shaving, that is something, some plastic
like the shaving down the Adam's apple, essentially.
Yes. So I do not actually do it. And the reason I don't do it is because, you know, that is a throat structure. And there are ear, nose, and throat specialists that are very well trained to do it. So I work with somebody who does do it. And, you know, the way that he does it is all through intraoral incisions. So if I were to do it, I would have to make an incision on the neck externally. And I just don't like that because it's a scar on your neck that's not necessary. So I work with a specialist. I'm a big, big believer when it comes to any kind of facial feminization, masculinization, any kind of facial work, that you really need to go to a specialist who focuses on that and has had the proper training to give you the best results for that. So I stick to the plastic surgery part of it, which is all the bony work and the soft tissue work. And then I have the ear, nose, and throat specialist, or the facial plastic surgeons, do the voice stuff and the tracheal shave. So when patients look at, you know, their physicians, if you go to a craniofacial plastic surgeon, that's somebody who did a full plastic surgery fellowship and then specialized in the face for an additional amount of time. When you go to a facial plastic surgeon in the United States, that's somebody who did an ear, nose, and throat specialist and then specialized in sort of cosmetic work for the face. So there are subtle differences in our trainings. But for me, I think it's really important to go to somebody who deals with throat structures when you're having throat surgery or tracheal surgery.
I hear it in your voice. Why is this such a passion for you in regards to feminization and dealing with the transgender community? Why is this important for you?
You know, I think that for me, when I started, when I went into plastic surgery in the very beginning, I wanted to do, and I still do it, cleft lip and craniofacial care for pediatric patients, right? And I've always had this feeling that people have the right and deserve the chance to be able to be a welcomed member or a part of society for who they want to be. And that everybody has the right to explore that and to establish that. And so when I started going into plastic surgery, it was for kids. It was like, okay, these are kids who have basically a hole where their lip should be closed. And it's very hard for them to fully integrate into society and to be able to explore who they really are when they have this change or this difference in their face, because they become defined by that rather than by who they really are. And as I was going through my training, I realized that, you know, the population, the trans population is a perfect example of this. You know, it's I'm very adamant about defining this as a reconstructive surgery. This is not cosmetic surgery. This is not somebody who, you know, just wants a little tweak here and there. This is somebody who fully identifies as the opposite gender and needs their face now to match that. And it's just giving the right to people to be able to say, this is who I am, and I'm proud of it, and I own it, and I can interact with other people. And the face is how you do that. Our first interaction with everybody in the daily world is our face, our expressions, how we speak, how we sound. It's how we present ourselves. And then that sort of allows you to really like bring everything you've got and contribute that to society. But if society is sort of blocking that because they are misgendering you for who you really are, you know, you can't contribute and be yourself. And so for me, it's just a way to allow people to honor themselves.
Have you seen, you mentioned earlier in regards to gender non-binary people seeking out your services, but in regards to the trans community and trans individuals, have you seen that growing more so as, you know, society accepts, you know, more and more of the LGBT community and the trans community? Are you seeing more trans individuals coming to you?
Yeah, so unfortunately in the United States, in our current political climate, there is now a lot of fear. Prior to our election, though, and in the past couple of years, yes, absolutely. And I'm very fortunate because I live in California where, you know, people are very accepting of the trans community and the LGBTQ community, and it's a widely celebrated community. And so here I'm a little bit sheltered from that, but I have patients all over the country, and there's a lot of fear now for those patients to be who they really are and to come forward. I think absolutely over the past couple of years, the community is more vocal and more open and coming forward for surgery and seeking the care that they deserve. But now there's been sort of this little bit of shift since the previous political climate has changed, that we're going backwards a little bit, and it's unfortunate. And I do think the pendulum swings, and it's just something we have to get through. And I will continue to be there for my patients and get through this time. But it's definitely something that was becoming much more widely accepted. I think that a big part of that is actually treating transgender youth. And a lot of our political conversations, and I hate that this has become a political topic, because to me, this is healthcare. It shouldn't be part of politics. But, you know, a lot of the transgender youth treatment was growing and giving puberty blockers and hormones, and it allows people to be who they are from a much younger age and accept themselves from a much younger age and come forward. And it actually helps developmentally, because patients don't sort of develop those really strong features of the opposite gender if they are on the appropriate hormone therapies. And I think with that and treating the youth, we actually were getting a whole generation of trans people who are so much more comfortable and therefore open and helping to educate other trans people. And unfortunately, again, this has now become a political thing where many people are misquoting some European studies about treating transgender youth and how we shouldn't be doing that. And now it's just become this unfortunate political mess, which it shouldn't be. But I think that definitely it's something we need to, especially in these times, to focus on and to maintain to get through these times.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm Eric Bradford, Olympic and world champion figure skater, pianist, and composer, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TG CD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
In June 2014, my team and I covered North America's first World Pride that happened right here in Toronto. The footage that we captured recently got turned into a documentary that's out right now. A Different Kind of Love is the name of the film, and available on OutTV and OutTV Proud, which is also available on Apple TV, Amazon Prime Video, and other streaming platforms. I hope you'll take a little time to check it out. A Different Kind of Love. So in June this year, I won the Out Loud Best in LGBT Radio Programming from the NCRA, the National Community Radio Association. I received that award for my episode on Operation Soap, the bathhouse raids that took place in Toronto, February 5th, 1981. So if you think what I'm doing here on Rainbow Country, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond, heard on broadcast radio, streaming, as well as available as an edited podcast. If you think what I'm doing here is worthwhile, I hope you'll consider making a donation to this very outlet you are tuned to. If you happen to be listening to the edited podcast, I hope you'll consider making a donation to an outlet that does carry Rainbow Country. How can you do that? Simple. Simply head over to marktara.ca, new URL, marktara.ca, and hit the donations banner, because that's where you'll find all the outlets that carry Rainbow Country. A little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. Have your voice, have your support be heard.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And of course our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So support, tune in. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Paul Poirier, Canadian champion in ice dance and three-time Olympian, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So, Dr. Grisham, you are a leading surgeon in facial feminization surgery. You have a successful Beverly Hills practice. Technology, I'm sure technology has helped to evolve your, what it is that you do, your practice. Can you talk to me about the use of technology when it comes to gender-affirming healthcare?
Absolutely. This is one of my favorite and most exciting topics because, so one of the reasons why I am so appreciative that I did my fellowship and I did the extra training that focused on facial feminization is because we really learned how to use technology to enhance these surgeries. So essentially right now, what we're using is something called virtual surgical planning. And basically that is where a patient goes and gets a CT scan of their skeletal structure. And then I'm able to look at that CT scan. And with a couple of these planning companies, I'm able to print a 3D model of that patient's skull. And then we take that 3D model and we print guides that help me in the operation to make cuts and refinements exactly where they need to be made in order to get the proportions from, just if we're using facial feminization as an example, from the anatomic male skull to the more feminized shape that we want the skull to be. And those are millimeter measurements. And we're only able to do that because we have this technology, this 3D printing and CT scan technology, where we're able to print these guides from a virtual scan. I think that, you know, now that we're really working with that technology and seeing how much we can do with that, I think that the next sort of frontier is going to be artificial intelligence. And I'm already working with a couple companies to say, like, based on the artificial intelligence and that software, what do we need to do to really maximize not only the skull, but also the soft tissue? And how can we sort of integrate these technologies to give us the best possible result? And I think for these surgeries, it's so important because it's a very extensive surgery and it needs to be planned. And the technology helps, you know, I'm a person, I'm a human, and I have my own aesthetic and I have my own visual understanding of space and proportions. And as an artist and a surgeon, I get that, but some of it's up to me. And it's nice to really have the technology to say, okay, less of it is up to you. You still need your artistry. You still need your hands and your skill set. But the actual cuts that need to be made, the precision work that needs to be done with technology. So it's much less subjective for me in the operating room when a patient's sleeping. And I have an actual surgical plan. So it's a super exciting part of plastic surgery in general, but especially for facial feminizations. Hmm.
Did you always want to get into healthcare? Did you always want to be a doctor? Did you grow up like, I want to cut people open?
So Mark, it's funny because when I was 9 years, my parents actually did not, you know, they suggested every other career for me. They're like, why are you doing this to yourself? But for as long as I can remember, I think I was about 9 when I told them I want to be a plastic surgeon. I was so skeptical. I wasn't even like, I want to be a doctor or in healthcare. I want to be a plastic surgeon who focuses on the face when I was 9. And I used to actually operate on my dolls and teddy bears. And I used to modify them and then give them plastic surgery. And I used to watch documentaries about like cleft lips and palates. And I was very stubborn. And I think I was about 9 years old, and my family's from South Africa, and there was a surgeon that my parents knew very well who was an oromaxillofacial surgeon. And they said to me when I was very young, I think it might have been 9 or 10, they said, go watch him in the OR. And I remember putting on the little like suit to go up, and I was a kid, I was a child, and I went into the OR, and I think my parents were hoping that I would get scared off, and I was sold. There was no convincing me. I just knew that that's where I needed to be. I don't know where it came from or why it was so strong, but it's been there since I was about 9 years old.
Wow. I remember, I think it was on TLC maybe, there was a show called, I think it was called Operation or The Operation or something, and they would show you these operations on these people. It was fascinating. I think it was on TLC, but anyway.
Oh, yeah. For as long as I can remember, I've been watching those, like, Discovery Channel.
Yeah.
There were, like, conjoined twins that I would watch them separate those twins. I was fascinated. And the game I used to love playing when I was little, I wasn't very, like, imaginative. I never played with dolls. I used to operate on my dolls, and I used to play that game Operation Obsessive. Mm-hmm. Where it beeps if you put the wrong organ in the wrong place. So... yeah.
Okay, so the ratio of the face's height to its width, the width of the mouth to the width of the nose, the distance between the eye and the width of the nose, these are said to approximate the golden ratio. The golden ratio. Is this something that you studied or you know of or that you use in your practice, the golden ratio?
Well, it's really interesting because when I have been also for as long as I can remember, sort of my hobby as a child and throughout school was art and visual arts. And so when I went to college, I took a ton of art classes and I actually chose my college where I would be able to go to the art school across the street and take classes there. So yes, I studied that in terms of like classical drawing and painting and sculpting. I did a lot of sculpture in college. And so I studied those ratios as an artist. And then as a plastic surgeon, when we study, we look at those. We absolutely look at those ratios. And we, you know, now when even when we're looking at a nose, every angle of the nose has a sort of normative range, what it should fall into for both males and females. And when I do these surgeries, all the measurements that we do through virtual surgical planning are according to those ratios and those numbers. And it gives us what is considered an aesthetically pleasing result. And, you know, it's absolutely true. Now, of course, there are, and I'll say this to all my patients, you know, when you look at movie stars and some of the most like widely considered beautiful people in the world, they oftentimes have a feature that lies outside of those ratios. You know, there are actresses whose eyes are further set apart and we consider them so beautiful. So every part of the face doesn't necessarily need to fit into that ratio to be beautiful, but we do want the overall proportions to fit within certain ratios so that when you're perceived by a person, another person, it's like, oh, that's a normal face, right? If you lie way too far outside of those ratios, then it becomes oftentimes like a congenital malformation, something that we need to reconstruct to get somebody within those ratios. But absolutely every case I do, I consider those numbers, all the angles, all the measurements, all the ratios of one facial feature to another. It's all part of the planning.
What do you find most challenging when it comes to what it is that you do, when it comes to gender-affirming healthcare? What is there something that you find that society still needs to get a hold on, or the government needs to get a hold on? Is there something that you seem to come up against time and time again that's frustrating when it comes to gender-affirming healthcare and you as a doctor, as a surgeon?
Absolutely. Getting my patients the insurance or the coverage for their cases extremely, extremely tasking and difficult. And the process takes a very long time. There is a ton of paperwork. It is expensive. It is time consuming. It is frustrating. It often requires multiple appeals with insurance companies. And, you know, but this is not just, I have to say, this is not just limited to trans care. This is healthcare in the United States. However, for this surgery, there are oftentimes misconceptions that this is an aesthetic surgery or a cosmetic surgery. Therefore, people think, oh, well, this is just like having a rhinoplasty or just like having lip fillers or whatever it is. And because there is this misperception that this is a cosmetic rather than a reconstructive procedure, it's quite difficult to convince these providers, these insurance providers and carriers, that this is reconstructive and we need to treat this the same way that we treat other reconstructive procedures, and that the patients need this and they need this in a timely manner. You know, there are currently wait lists at some of these hospitals that are years long. One, because there are not a ton of providers who are trained to do these surgeries, and two, because the insurances just take a very long time to approve every case, and it's a lot of back and forth, and it's very frustrating for patients, right? Because they want their surgeries, and I'm ready to go, and they can see that I'm ready to go, and they're ready to go, and we have all our ducks in a row, and then it's just this waiting game, and it's weekly, like, nope, we still don't have an answer, we still don't have an answer, and it's very, very frustrating.
So is it a matter of changing how these organizations look at it from, you know, a cosmetic thing to a reconstructive thing?
I think that's part of it, but I think, you know, it's just healthcare in the United States and getting everything passed through insurance companies is a challenge. It's very, very difficult, you know. If you are coordinating, there are multiple moving, you know, there are parts to this too. It's not just giving the surgeon authority from the company to do it. I'm not the only one who needs approval. They also have to give the surgery center or the hospital approval. They have to give the anesthesiologist approval. We have to figure out post-op care. So there are many moving parts to this. And while I may be in network for an insurance company, the anesthesiologist or the surgery center may not be. So there are, unfortunately, there's a lot of administrative sort of stuff that gets in the way of getting these cases approved in a time efficient. You know, there's a lot of red tape that you have to go through, and it's just very, very frustrating for the patients. I think it's going to be a change of perception. It's going to be an acceptance of the LGBTQ community. It's going to be a change in how insurance companies work, which I don't know how that's possible, because, you know, this has been a challenge for the United States healthcare system for forever. And it's just a lack of efficiency of our healthcare system. And it, like I said, this is not something that is specific to these cases. This is unfortunately just the state of health in the United States.
When it comes to your transgender clientele, do they come from all areas of the U.S.?
You know, so yes, they do, but so there are laws in place that, because I have my license in California, I have to practice within California. So all of my patients have to be seen in California. So even if I do virtual consultations, whatnot, they do need preoperative appointments, and I need to have them in person in California before surgery. People are free to go to other states for surgeries, but they have to be in the state for a certain amount of time before the surgery, so that, you know, they can make an informed decision of whether or not they want to proceed after having met me, having been in California. Now, different insurances and how the insurances work out of state and in state is very dependent on the insurance company provider, the patient's benefits. So, you know, whether or not the insurances will cover the cases if they go to other states is totally dependent on the patient's insurance.
So, Dr. Gisham, here's my last question for you. You are an award-winning medical professional. You've co-authored a number of peer-reviewed medical journal articles. You have a successful Beverly Hills practice. Congrats to you on all of those things. But for you, at the end of the day, what makes you most proud of at the end of the day, once everything is said and done, what are you most proud of?
My relationship with my patients is everything to me. It's just, all the rest of it is fluff. You know, for me, it's all about the conversation I get to have in that room, or the hug I get to share when we're done with a surgery and somebody looks in the mirror and for the first time feels comfortable in their body. Like, it is the most rewarding experience that I can. It's almost hard to verbalize, honestly, at how you feel when somebody sees their face and they feel now comfortable presenting themselves and they identify with who they see. You know, I can't, that single moment after surgery is worth everything to me. You know, every fight with an insurance company, all the education and the time it took to get here, that makes everything worth it. But you know, it's also a process. Like, I love the journey of having my patient come in and getting to know them. And it's like I've said a couple of times, this is such a personal experience. And my patients, I tell them, I drive my patients nuts. They have my cell phone number and I'll text them. I think I actually drive them crazy checking in on them. But it's such a personal experience. We become family. Mm. And
you,
to me,
you help to change people's lives.
But they don't, I think what patients don't realize is they're changing my life more than I'm changing theirs. Mm. And it's really true, and that might sound sort of cliche, but it's really, when you go into medicine and when you've loved medicine for so long, it's really, it's huge. They have, especially the trans population, has completely changed who I am as a person, because it's a population of some of the most strong, brave, powerful people I have ever met. And it is so inspiring on a daily basis to face the world knowing, like, you know, some of my patients will tell me what they've gone through. And I'm like, if that person can go through all of that and be such a strong, empowered, bold, like, wonderful, warm person at the end of it all, like, I have no excuses, you know? So it's just so motivating. And it's just a population that just, I'm totally honored and privileged to be able to work with this population.
Mm, well said, well said. Dr. Gishon, well said, well done. Thanks for your time. Thank you for what you're doing there in California. You. Well done to you. You know,
I wish that every state were as open and forward-thinking as California, but we'll get there.
In time.
In time. Everything takes time.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much. Have a great one. It was really lovely to meet you.
For even more on this award-winning medical professional, simply visit drkriya.com.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing, based on a person's sexual orientation, was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill. But without some progressive conservative legislators' backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, this is Michael Anthony Alago, music executive, photographer, author, and you are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Stay locked in. Coming up next, hour two of Rainbow Country.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st. Help us raise $25,000 to support our local arts and artists and keep our community informed with local news, concerts, and events listings on air and on our website. Visit CFRC.ca today and make your gift to Kingston.